We are going to say goodbye to an old friend, the book of Genesis. What an amazing journey it has been in looking at not only the creation of the world and the Lord establishing His purpose and His plan, but the calling out of Abraham and his family, of which the book of Genesis is mostly about. Jacob has said his goodbyes in the form of a prophetic blessing upon all of his children. And an amazing blessing it was, prophetic, describing in detail that you can actually test and challenge. In fact, that's one of the most amazing things about the Bible. It's testable. It's challengeable. You can actually research it. You can find the places, the people groups, archaeological finds that verify and confirm these things. But more than that, just the prophetic announcement, it's just because God wants you to know that He wrote this book. He signed His name in the form of prophecy. And so we saw this amazing feature. But when you go back to the very call of Abraham, God said He would multiply His descendants as the stars of the sky, as the sand on the seashore. Amazing picture of what would take place, and yet it seemed like a very slow, slow start. In fact, you kind of wonder what in the world is going on, because it seems like Abraham is not having a child. His wife is barren for many years, and life took its turns, not as he expected. And I think in many ways there's a great picture for us. Life takes turns we don't understand. We have these amazing promises in the Bible. We have these amazing promises of that God will be with you. He'll never leave you nor forsake you. But there are times, like Abraham, you wonder what's going on. And you'll be tempted, like Abraham, to take matters into your own hands. And of course, in his case, thinking that he could help God with the child situation, he had a surrogate. Hagar stepped in for Sarah. He was a surrogate mother. She bore Ishmael, and they raised Ishmael, and he thought, this is the one. And of course, we know as a result of Abraham's decision to help God out, right now, over in the Middle East, as we speak, there is a war between the children of Ishmael and the children of Isaac. So don't help God out. You'll only create problems. It's an interesting picture here. But God spoke again, reiterated His promise. Isaac was born, and the Lord gave Abraham the sense that this was the future. But He promised Abraham that they would be in Egypt for 400 years, and they would be enslaved, and then they would be rescued with a great deliverance. So they have this understanding of what's going to take place, and this is what they're working with at this point. Now, Jacob has, by faith, blessed the sons of Joseph, but he's given Judah the leadership. Now we come to the end of this patriarchal period, and this chapter ends kind of, well, sad and tragic. Two funerals and a whole lot of fears expressed here in this chapter. Yet there's one little phrase in this chapter that we will find our focus mainly upon, and that phrase we'll see a little bit later. I'm not going to tell you what it is yet, because it's really going to pull all of this together, and it's not unlike our lives that seem to be filled with all kinds of challenges and pains and difficulties and, you know, uncertainties. But were it not for this phrase, we would have lost hope. But God has the same thing working in our lives. Essentially, it's all good how this works out. So we come to chapter 50. Jacob has died. Joseph, verse 1, it says, fell on his father's face and wept over him and kissed him. I think we've all been at the deathbed. Many of us have been the deathbed of a loved one, and how hard that is to say our final goodbyes and realize they're no longer there. And of course, there's that emotion. They know by faith that they'll see each other again. We know we will see our loved ones again if they're believers in the Lord, and that we will be together, united again, but still we're human. And we face those very sorrowful moments. A good friend of mine just lost a 32-year-old son, and worked with him a lot. This is kind of the picture. Well, Joseph then commanded his servants, the physicians, to embalm his father, being that he had that technology of the Egyptians. In fact, all the archaeological finds we have now and all of the writings and the resources, the Egyptology, we can kind of piece together exactly what would go on with this process. It was kind of an interesting process. You know, I mean, I can't help but be a little bit skeptical of the reasoning behind it as a religious money-making scheme. Because essentially the cult of Osiris had dictated that the body had to be preserved so the deceased could enjoy the afterlife. So they created a business of embalming. and it was quite lucrative. Problem is, if you're poor, the best they could do is wash your body and lay it out in the sun until you all dried up, and hopefully that would give you some preservation and some halfway decent afterlife, they thought. Some others had a little more money, they could pack them with salt. Others more well-to-do would be injected with juniper oil and their organs removed, but the rich got the full service plan. Essentially, if you had a lot of money, you could get all of the above plus a body wrap. You'd be fully mummified. And essentially, by doing this, it would close the pores and it would essentially preserve the flesh, much like the tanning of leather does today. So this gives tanning a whole new meaning. Jacob is now gone. But this process done to his body, I don't believe, was because of some cult and some direction that Joseph had been connected with the Egyptians. I think it was a practical matter because he is about to fulfill a promise that he two times made a promise to his father, and his father was very interested that he not be buried in Egypt. So Joseph, I believe, is embalming him for practical reasons. It says 40 days, verse 3, were required for him, for such are the days required for those who were embalmed, and the Egyptians mourned for him for 70 days. But when the days of his mourning were past, Joseph spoke to the household of Pharaoh, saying, if I now found favor in your eyes, please speak in the hearing of Pharaoh, saying, my father made me swear, saying, behold, I'm dying in my grave, which I dug for myself in the land of Canaan. There you shall bury me. Now, therefore, please let me go up and bury my father, and I will come back. And Pharaoh said, go up and bury your father as he made you swear. So Joseph has the complete trust of the Pharaoh that he will go and return. Joseph is a significant leader in Egypt. He has been the savior of the nation. Just even watching in that generation, we know that ultimately the descendants of Abraham will be a blessing to the whole world, as is promised. But even now, we see Joseph, the great grandson of Abraham, has essentially saved the nation of Egypt, having the wisdom and the interpretation of the dream that there would be 7 years of good and 7 years of famine saved the nation and also saved his people. So now he's asking to go, and so now the official funeral procession, verse 7 through 11, Joseph went up to bury his father. And with him went, number one, all of the servants of Pharaoh, the elders of his house, and the elders of the land of Egypt. So all of the who's who of Egypt, all of the glitterati are present and accounted for. This is a big, huge state funeral. And as well, all the household of Joseph, his brothers, his father's house, only their little ones, their flocks, and their herds they left in the land of Goshen. So the family of Jacob is present. And thirdly, there went with him, verse 9, both chariots and horsemen, and it was a very great gathering. So they have a military entourage to boot, probably for security reasons as they're outside of the borders of Egypt. A special elite units, no doubt, for the security of these important officials. Imagine what Abraham would think seeing this. This Bedouin in the land of Canaan, this wanderer, this one who crossed over the river, this Hebrew, been told these marvelous promises, but has not seen the fulfillment of much of it. He's seen Isaac being born. But he hasn't seen a whole lot else, because he was old when he had Isaac. And yet here, imagine him seeing all of Egypt coming out to honor the death of his grandson, Jacob. And to know that this Egypt honored this man because he fathered the man who saved the nation. I can't help but notice a little bit of an irony here. All the chariots of Egypt are honoring Israel in leaving Egypt to go. And 400 years later, all of the chariots of Egypt will leave Egypt as well to go after Israel, but not for a good thing, to actually try to destroy them. Of course, the entire army then will be destroyed in the Red Sea. So it's a little bit of an interesting period where, in a sense, Jacob is making his exodus out of Egypt. And later in type, you're going to see the entire nation make an exodus out of Egypt. But listen, more than that, for our own lives, one day we will make our exodus out of this world. And to realize this world is not everything. People who have a materialistic mentality that what they live in this life, that's it, and once this life is over, it's done, do not understand that they were uniquely created. That special DNA code that God has uniquely for each person, there is more than just the physical makeup, that God has also given that person a soul. That soul will live on. And that's the subject of what we need to understand in regard to our salvation. Well, they come to the threshing floor of Atad, which is beyond the Jordan, and they mourn there for with a great and solemn lamentation. He observed 7 days of mourning for his father. In verse 11, it says, when the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, saw the mourning at the threshing floor of Atad, they said, this is a deep mourning of the Egyptians. Therefore, the name was given or called Abel Mizraim, which is beyond the Jordan. And of course, it means the mourning of Egypt. So his sons did for him as he had commanded them. Verse 13, his sons carried him to the land of Canaan and buried him in the cave of the field of Machpelah before Mamre, which Abraham bought with the field from Ephron the Hittite as property for a burial place. Now, I know if you're new to the Bible or you're new to this study, it's kind of an annoying thing sometimes to read all these names and places and peoples and you wonder, well, how does this really relate to me? What does this mean for me? It seems distracting. But understand that the Lord does not want to have any way that someone could approach the Bible and say, well, you know, we don't really know this is accurate. There are lots of religious books written with philosophical ideas. How do we know that's not true and the Bible's true? How do we know to be certain these things are so? I believe, honestly, the Lord allows so many of these places and people groups to be mentioned that if someone really digs below the surface, you can find how these things fit. In fact, who would have ever imagined the possibility to get 66 books, compile them together with all the different subjects and all the different historical records and, you know, statements of fact, all of that together, you would have a conglomeration normally with all kinds of different disjointed viewpoints. But yet it fits as a perfect unity. And many of these places, the archaeologist has actually dug up and discovered. In fact, when you talk to those archaeologists in the Middle East, they will say that the Bible is an amazing, reliable source. One of the greatest experts in archaeology, Nelson Glick, said this, and he wasn't a believer. He wasn't a believer in the Lord, but he said this. He says, I know of no record in antiquity that even can come close to the Bible for its accuracy. As he did his work, and he would say, oh, there's a city between this city and that city according to the Bible, then let's find it. It's there, and they would. So I think the reason why those things are mentioned, at least in that sense, but also, you know, you see another picture here. It says, you know, after he buried his father, Joseph returned to Egypt, he and his brothers and all who went up with him to bury his father. This promise that was made, you see the fulfillment of it. Now he's fulfilling this promise. And he's asked to be buried in the place where Leah was. And so the remains of Abraham, Sarah, Isaac, and Rebekah and Leah are in this cave. And eventually, Joseph is going to ask to be returned to this area, because by faith, what they're saying is, I don't care about Egypt. I don't care about the most prosperous, most powerful nation of the world. I care about honoring God. And he told us he's going to give us this land. In fact, as we go on through prophecy and scriptures, we know that that land that he gives to Abraham and his descendants will be a matter of great consternation to the whole world. According to Zechariah, in the last days, that Jerusalem will be a heavy stone, a burden for the whole world. They'll want to get rid of it. They'll want to not deal with it, but it's going to keep coming back to them. And here we are in our sophisticated 21st century, and we're concerned about what's happening in the Middle East. Our president was just over there. We're concerned of what's going to happen. All eyes are on Israel because of the tensions between Iran and Russia, and all of those nations surrounding Israel as the Bible depicted. In fact, Ezekiel describes all of those nations in their names of antiquity so that as names change over time, you'd know which one he's talking about. They're all in place. We're very close. Or this could be a birth pang that maybe we'll have another period of time. We don't know. But I'll tell you what, I think we should be very, very carefully observing what's happening here. Prophecy. So now Jacob is dead. He lived a long life, and you find Jacob always wrestled with his old nature and his new nature and received that new name, Israel, but it seemed to never stick until the end. And now he's died by faith, and he's been buried. But now we come to an interesting challenge. The brothers of Joseph. The brothers of Joseph, verse 15, saw their father was dead, and they said, "Perhaps Joseph will hate us and may actually repay us for the evil which we did to him." So they sent messengers to Joseph, saying, "Before your father died, he commanded, saying, 'Thus you shall say to Joseph, I beg you, please forgive the trespass of your brothers and their sin, for they did evil to you. Now please forgive the trespass of the servants of the God of your father.' And Joseph wept when they spoke to him. And his brothers also went and fell down before his face. And they said, 'Behold, we are your servants.'" What's happening here? Well, you know, he's already told his brothers, look, Genesis 45, remember? He says, "Don't be grieved or angry with yourselves that you sold me into Egypt. For, listen, you sold me here, but God sent me before you to preserve life." He said to them, "Look, he's raised me up to save your lives by a great deliverance. So it wasn't you who sent me, it was God." That brings a very, very important point. Up in our experience, in our lives, here, first of all, the fears that his brothers have are totally unfounded. But, you know, put yourself in their shoes. You know, you did this most horrific act. You sold your brother because you were envious. And as he sold the brother into Egypt, of course, everything unfolds. Eventually, they discover he's the most powerful man in Egypt, save the Pharaoh, and that he has their lives in his hands. But yet, he shows some grace, and he brings them all to Egypt, and he's been, for the last 17 years, very kind, very sensitive, very thoughtful. But you don't believe it. There's something there that makes you wonder, you know, and maybe when our father dies, he's going to turn into the Count of Monte Cristo. He's going to get his revenge on those who did him wrong. Maybe he's just playing it cool because he's subtly going to destroy us. Why would they think that? Why do people think these things about others? One of the number one reasons that I can come up with in my mind why his brothers would have that doubt nagging in their mind about where his brother was because in their mind, if the shoe was on the other foot, if they were in Joseph's place, they kind of know how they would feel. If they have absolute power like Joseph, and I think that's probably very intimidating too, to know your brother, who you weren't really fond of, you know, you scorned him, and you even went so far as to sell him as a slave, to find out that this man now, his word is law. He's so powerful that he could say to any number of 1,000 servants, "Do this," and immediately it's done. And I mean, everything he says is law. He has absolute power. You'd be a little nervous because in your heart, you know what you would do with that power. I think people struggle with God in this regard because it's kind of a frightening thought to know that God has absolute power. And we have a natural fear, and yet our fears are utterly unfounded and completely without merit because this is the heart of God. It's seen in Joseph as he describes it here. Notice, Joseph said to them, "Do not be afraid, for am I in the place of God?" The first thing I see about Joseph, and he's just like Jesus in his words of comfort, though he had all this power, he had actually chosen to serve them. He goes on to say, "As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good in order to bring it about as it is this day to save many people alive. Now therefore, do not be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones." And he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. Amazing. You know, here he is, with all of his power, he's telling them, "Look, I am here to serve you." You know, that's an amazing type of Jesus who, being in the very form of God, did not consider it robbery to be equal with God, the Bible tells us, but he came down and became in the form of a servant. He did not come to be served, but to serve. Here he is. I mean, just imagine, you know, the picture of Jesus hanging out with these fishermen. The King of the universe, the one who created all things, hanging out with a bunch of fishermen. And they're clueless as to just who this really is. And yet he's so patient, so gracious, so kind. I'm amazed how he has come to serve. Then he goes on to say, "You meant it for evil." Verse 20, he says, "As for you, you meant evil against me." Now, up to this point, to their credit, they have not denied that. In fact, I think in one sense that it's pretty noble of them to own up to it. They're not going to try to cover it. Of course, it'd be hard to cover that. I mean, Joseph was there. He knows exactly what they did. So they have to basically say, all right, it's on the table. We were pretty much scoundrels to do that to you. So they call it what it is. They call it evil. They call it trespass. They call it sin. The only thing here that bothers me is I'm not really quite sure I believe them when they say that before your father died, he commanded us to say this to you. I don't buy it. I think they're just making this up because they're really afraid of Joseph. But Joseph, nonetheless, and I'm sure he could see right through it, he's trying to encourage them. Guys, I'm not in the place of God. You know, I see my role here. He recognized his authority came from God and that he was raised up to save the nation. So he was there to be a servant, to lay his life down. And though they meant it for evil, and certainly it was evil, I'm not saying by any stretch that evil is not there. It was there. Real scorn, real hatred, real evil in what they did. But he says in the next phrase, "You meant it for evil against me." Now the next phrase, this two-word phrase, in verse 20, I want you to circle, I want you to date, I want you to ponder, because this phrase comes to bear in a sense, is really a picture of the gospel. But God. What do you experience in life? We all have all kinds of experiences, some pains, some struggles, some good things. We tend to take credit for everything the good that happens that's good in our lives, right? I mean, when something good happens, you know, it's usually because of our genius, our ability, our talent, our charisma. You know, we've made things good happen for us. When bad things happen, what do? We usually blame God. We take credit for the good, we blame him for the bad. Joseph, I love how he acknowledges this. "You meant it for evil against me, but God meant it for good." Before he said, "It was not you who sent me, but it was God who sent me to Egypt." Now, it was them, but Joseph, you see, does not look at secondary causes. You know, he understands God is absolutely sovereign, and I think it's very important for us to not look at secondary causes. What are secondary causes? Well, somebody at work doesn't like you. Put a bad report into you to the boss. The boss then overlooks you for the promotion and gives it to this other person. That's a secondary cause. They messed with you. They hurt you. They did evil. But the first cause is God. Isn't God behind? Look, this is going to stretch some of your minds. This is a big chunk of meat from the scriptures. I'm going to try to cut it up as best I can. But some of you are going to choke on this. It's a tough one. Now, some of you have been around for a while. You've been seasoned. You've matured. You understand that God's purposes go so much deeper than we can see and fathom. And you've got more accustomed to trust the Lord what you can't comprehend. There is purpose in it. It may seem like a tangled piece of cloth that doesn't make any sense, but there is purpose in it. See, the Bible tells us, "For all things work together for good." Now, certainly it did in Joseph's life, but you might counter and say, "Well, wait a minute, yeah, that's all well and good, but it took years for it to work out for Joseph." I know one thing, I know human nature. You don't want to hear years. You don't want to hear months. I don't even want to hear a week. I want it now. An answer. This pain, this problem, I need an answer now. And this is really the big challenge. I also see the same tendency, not just in those that are going through a trial or difficulty, but also those who are going through, well, maybe they're developing in their leadership. You know, new leaders, there's new people that are serving the Lord. And the first thing you notice when you start serving the Lord is how many people aren't. And you get so excited about the vision the Lord's given you, you're frustrated with all those that can't get it. How come they don't understand it? Or you're frustrated with the pastor. How come he can't see my ministry is the most important ministry here in the church? And I kind of amused sometimes because I know what I was like when I was just a new leader. You get that myopic vision of this is so important. And why doesn't everybody see this? But what happens is, you see, we're not willing to be patient for people. Look, the Bible tells us it takes time for Christ to be formed in people. It takes time for us to mature. You know, people are not going to get these things. It takes time to raise the level of consciousness and awareness of the things of God. It takes time. We need to be patient. And certainly, one thing about Joseph is he exemplifies patience. Because you might look at him say this and go, well, okay, fine. But he's numero uno in Egypt now. Easy to say, yeah, God, but God worked it all out. He meant it for good after the fact. I challenge you, find one place where Joseph ever complained against God. When he was in the midst of being sold by his brothers, he never railed against them. When he was falsely accused by Potiphar's wife and thrown into prison. When he was made a slave, he became the best slave possible. When he was made a prisoner, he became the best prisoner possible. Listen, one of the biggest challenges in our generation right now, this has got to be, it's up there, is that people seem to have very few coping skills. Those of you who are own businesses and you hire young people today, you've probably seen this. Like any setbacks, people have a hard time with any kind of challenge, any kind of difficulty. They can't deal with it. And we're far over-medicated in this nation than we should be. Because people don't want to deal with pain and difficulties and troubles. You know, they want to feel good now. I want to feel good now. I don't want to have to go through this time of grief or pain or struggle. And it's very easy to pop a pill. It is. Now, I'm not maligning everybody on medication. Please, I hope you know. I know there are some very real issues out there that you better listen to your doctor. But I think, on the whole, the average number of people are going down that road way too often. The challenge is then they don't cope. They can't cope. Yet you look at Joseph, and like Daniel, it reminds me of Daniel. Daniel, here's a young man ripped from his family, probably saw them killed, thrust into this training program with all these other boys. They're shaved, they're made into eunuchs. I mean, just picture the trauma he would have experienced. And yet, there was something about Daniel. He knew who he was. He knew his God, and he was a standout. Those around him recognized he found favor in their eyes because the leader would be used to seeing all the whimpering, simpering kids in the corner after all this trauma. But not Daniel, something different, and not Joseph, because he truly believes God meant this for good. The Bible tells us a wonderful promise. God turns all things together for good to those who love God and are called according to his purpose. Now, here's the truth. No matter how well off a person is now, no matter how delightful life is, no matter how prosperous, happy they may be at the moment, no matter how the sun is shining down on them right now, if they do not love God, if God is not their God, it will not end well for them. It will not turn out for the best. They are under the wrath of God. You probably heard people remark, well, it all turns out for the best. Frankly, that's sentimental nonsense. But as a Christian, if you love God, you have a basis for that statement that all things work together for good, that all things turn out for the best, because they do. And that's the exciting thing about being a believer in the Lord. You can trust your God. Listen, follow the heroes of the Bible. Follow those whom the Lord picked out. Did he protect them from all pain? No. Why not? He could. But he doesn't. You can't just say, well, you know, that was evil, but that was the free will of man that did all that evil. God certainly wouldn't have done that. And certainly God is not the originator of evil. But he could stop it. So ultimately, you have to come back to that aspect. And here's the challenge for us. If you open up a watch, you see all the mechanism in the back, all the wheels and the cogs spinning around and things going back and forth. It all makes no sense to the untrained eye. You turn it around, you see it keeps perfect time. You know, we can't see things. One pastor, a great illustration, he had a bookmark in his Bible that he always used for an illustration. I don't have one like that, so I can't use it, but I can tell you about it. He'd pull it out and he'd say, what does this look like to you? And the back of the bookmark, you'd see, just it looked like a bunch of tangled knots of different colored threads and just all a mess and looked like nothing. Looked chaotic. You turn it around. On the front side, you saw a beautiful tapestry. This is in many ways the problem and the dilemma that we have, that we need to, by faith, look how Joseph looks. Because we see things in our lives and the world around us, it looks chaotic, it looks out of control, not making any sense. Why are the wicked prospering? Why are all things going so crazy? Why are leaders in Washington and Trenton so nuts? You know, with some of the laws they're passing, they're focusing instead of on the economy, they're spending all their days writing these laws that are going to basically make it difficult for Christians to speak the Bible. Doesn't make sense. But God. But God. Whatever is meant for evil, whatever is evil out there, but God. Think of David running for his life from Saul for 20 years. What's the purpose in that? I don't know. Looks chaotic to me. But turn it around, God made him into a man in that period of time. I think of the difficulties in my own life. I consider a number of the worst things that happened in my life from the time my mother died when I was 4. My grandmother then took us in. You know, a traumatic difficulty in wrestling that I'm expecting to win the state championship and end up with mononucleosis and I end up taking 4th, crushing my ego. I mean, I think of the biggest things that happened to me. Dad had left. So many things like that. And yet I look back and I see how God turned them into good. And at the time, it was pretty chaotic. At the time, it didn't make sense. At the time, I didn't understand. But it's a matter of perspective. I'm reminded of a little boy that was, he'd walk home from school and his parents always warned him, don't go through the park because that's right next to the psychiatric hospital and we want you to go around, stay by the neighborhood. But it was a longer walk and he was, you know, a little boy and trying to be efficient. He'd go through the park anyway until one day he's walking through the park and all of a sudden he sees this guy climbing over the fence from the psychiatric hospital. And he gets a little nervous so he starts walking faster but unfortunately their eyes made contact. So he's walking faster, but he hears the footsteps of this man faster after him. So he starts to run. Then he hears the footsteps running. He starts to just fly, and he hears the footsteps coming after him, bearing down on him, getting closer and closer and closer. He's terrified. He trips over a log and falls. And just then, these footsteps bearing right on top of him, a big arm comes out and reaches toward him, and he's frozen in fear, and the hand touches him and says, "Tag, you're it," and runs the other way. This is kind of how our fears work on us. How we see things. We don't see everything. That's the problem. We judge way too soon. There is a hidden wisdom. The deepest, darkest moment in human history was when they took the most innocent of all, the one who had never sinned, and they put him up on the cross. But even Jesus said, "No one takes my life. I lay it down." When he was standing before Pilate, the king of the universe, before this petty politician. And this politician says, "Don't you know I have the authority to crucify you or release you?" And Jesus calmly says, "You would have no authority over me except it were given to you from above." And I think the challenge for us is to learn that God turned that worst moment in history into our salvation. Just like to Joseph, the worst moment for him was turned into salvation for the nation. Human wisdom doesn't get this. But God speaks a wisdom not of this age, nor of the rulers of this age who are coming to nothing. They can't understand it. The wisdom of God is a hidden wisdom. So what was it about Joseph that made him so special? I believe it's right here, this phrase, "but God," because this is the story of his life. Everything he attributed to the Lord. Whether it was pain, he knew the Lord allowed it. For whatever reason, he was okay with waiting to find out. We need to learn to cultivate that patience, to wait, to find out what is going on, because we can't figure it out at times. But when good things would happen, he wouldn't take the credit for that. He would say to Pharaoh, "Look, it is not in me to answer this dream, but God will give you an answer of peace." So he gave God the credit for the good and the bad, and knowing that even the bad, God is meaning for good, which is a great thing. Again, don't get caught up in secondary causes. To the Lord, you could say, just like Jesus said to Pilate, "You have no authority over me except what is given to you." And that is true in every area of life. Who are you afraid of? Who are you intimidated by? Who are you freaked out about? Who do you tremble under? Listen, don't tremble under man who has the need of oxygen to fill his lungs to live. What is that? Fear God. Jesus said it. Don't fear him who can take your life here. Fear Him who can not only take your life, but also consign your soul to eternity. That's whom you ought to be more concerned about. I recall that famous book by a rabbi in Boston, Harold Kushner, When Bad Things Happen to Good People. You know, it's amazing how many people thought that was a wonderful book. It was an instant bestseller, 1 million hardcovers sold, went to paperback, it went ballistic, 52 weeks in the New York Times bestselling list. But I don't know how many people would recall his conclusions. His conclusion was this, that God is all-loving but not all-powerful. He said, when bad things happen to good people, it is not because that God is not loving, but it's because He can't control the evil. It's too much for Him. Now, Harry, I'm sorry, buddy, but a good but helpless God is not the God of the Bible. It might be your God, but that's not the God of the Bible. God is not good but helpless. You can't explain away evil in that simple form. It's better to say we just fail to comprehend the greater purposes that God is allowing this evil thing to happen. The reason bad things happen to good people are totally in the realm of God's decree, which we can't possibly comprehend. It's like that tangled tapestry that makes no sense. But God knows. Like Job. Job had no clue what was happening to him. What were the forces behind it? But what I love about Job, he says, the Lord gives and the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Now some might want to say, well, wait a minute, the Lord gave, but it was Satan who took it away. Well, Satan was at best a tool in the hands of God. Satan at best was just allowed to do this for a season, for greater purposes that God had. Now this is a challenge. I'm telling you, this is a challenge. This is a big chunk of meat to consider the sovereignty of God. But I'm not talking about fate. This is not fatalistic by any stretch. Your choices make a big difference. Don't think that your choices don't matter because God's going to work it out anyway. No, your choices make a big difference. And the first choice we all need to make is to learn to trust the Lord in things we don't understand. Joseph models this for us. He's composed his spirit in patience. He's trusting the Lord will do His thing in His time, and the Lord then raises him up. And so Joseph says, look, you meant it for evil, but God, it's all good. He meant it, He intended it for good. And so there is the basis of the forgiveness that Joseph has. That's why he can be completely forgiving to these brothers despite what they did. And that's how you forgive, by faith. So you know, it's all in God's hands. Whatever they did to you, the Lord ultimately allowed it. Why don't you learn from it? Why don't you grow from it? Maybe the Lord's testing your patience. Maybe He's testing your love. Maybe He's testing whether you forgive or not. Problem is, we need to see the bigger picture. You know the one man who didn't forgive. He had a debt. Jesus tells the story, the parable of the man whose master found he really messed up and he owed him $1 million. I'll put it in our language today. And he goes to the man and says, you better pay that debt. I'm going to throw you in jail. And the man pleaded with him, I can't pay it. I blew it. I'm sorry. Please forgive me. And the man forgave him the entire $1 million debt. So he's going on his way all happy. He got forgiven of this debt, but you know, he's a little short on cash. He sees a guy who owes him $20. Hey, dude, pay me what you owe me. I can't. I don't have it. You know, I'll pay you. If you don't pay it, I'm going to throw you in jail. Please, you know, forgive me, help me, wait for me. But he was not willing to give this friend a break, and he threw him in jail for $20. So Jesus said, when the master finds out what this man did after he forgave him $1 million, what do you think he's going to do? Yeah, you guessed it. Not going to be too happy about that. In many ways, what happens is we just do not see the big picture. We oftentimes so self-absorbed, we can't see how God puts all things together. God works it for good. Now, I'd love for you to do a homework assignment because there are many different places in the Bible that phrase, but God is found. It's found in Ephesians when God speaks about the sin of man, but then He says, but God, who is rich in mercy, because of the love with which He loved us, He says, even when we were dead in trespasses and sins, made us alive together with Christ. By grace you've been saved. So that's a great, but God. There's others. But God demonstrates His own love toward us, that while we were sinners, Christ died for us. Throughout the Scriptures, there are dozens of these phrases, but God. I'd encourage, if you've got a computer program that can search, you can do a little search of the phrase, but God, and you can find them all, and you'll have a devotional record for many months to come, just to ponder on these things. So now we come to the final point, and essentially Joseph is going to die, but he's going to die in faith. Hebrews 11, verse 22 says that when Joseph was dying, he made mention of the departure of the children of Israel and gave instructions concerning his bones. That's what we see right here. Joseph dwelt in Egypt, he and his father's household, and Joseph lived 110 years. And Joseph saw Ephraim's children, that was his son, to the third generation. That means he had his great-grandchildren around him. I'll tell you what, being a grandparent, it is a wonderful thing. My little grandson and granddaughter were here this morning, and just holding my little granddaughter, she's such a happy baby, and oh, she's always smiling. She has this funny laugh that I recorded on my phone, and I listen. I just break out in a big smile. And you know, there's something about that. Your children's children. I still remember. I mean, having children's wonderful. I still remember and picture in my mind my little daughter when she was about 5 or 6, and I'd come home from the office, and she'd hear I was home, and she'd scream, "Daddy!" And she'd come running around the corner, and I'd still picture her running across the kitchen floor, jumping off the landing. Before I could put my bags down, she'd fly into my arms. I had to drop everything to catch her. Oh, man, it was so wonderful thing. And now my little baby has a baby. It's wonderful. So I could just picture this experience, this full life that Joseph has. I think if you asked him, "Hey, was it worth being sold as a slave by your brothers and being falsely accused, thrown into prison? You did time, you know, hard time there a little bit. Was that worth it?" You know what? Wherever you are right now, just know this. Whatever experience you have, whatever pain you're going through, this will not last forever. You've got to learn to possess your souls with patience to trust the Lord. Look at how God's dealings with His people are good when they trust Him, which is our part. He does the work. Our part is to trust Him. Then he saw the children of Machir, the son of Manasseh, who were brought up on Joseph's knees. So he's got his grandkids, his great-grandkids all around him. And Joseph said to his brethren, "I'm dying." Well, how about that? What's the next two words? Verse 24. "I'm dying." Everybody together. "But God." How about that? You know, this is so peppered throughout the Scriptures. "I am dying," he says. Now, dying is not a pleasant thing. And yet I have to say, as a pastor, I've been at the deathbed of a number that I've been more ministered to than I've ministered to them. I've been blown away at their peace. I picture, you know, a number of times where we've said to someone, "Look, your wife is going to be okay. Your children are going to be okay. We're going to be here for them. It's okay. You can go." And moments later, they go. And you can sense that peace, that release. Because we know that though death was not originally intended by God, it came in the world because of sin, to the believer, it has no more sting. There's no more fear and foreboding of hell and separation from God. It will in fact mean more life, entering into more life, having a new body, a new glorious existence, more full. So Joseph said to his brethren, "I'm dying, but God will surely visit you." There's the prediction. He's going to come back and bring you out of this land to the land which He swore to Abraham. This was said hundreds of years before it happened. To Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. And then Joseph took an oath from the children of Israel saying, "God will surely visit you and you shall carry up my bones from here." So just as Hebrews says, he tells them, God's going to come back, you're going to leave, but you better bring my bones with you. Why is this? Joseph spent 93 of his 110 years in Egypt. He was in Egypt all that time. But Egypt was not in him. That's a great lesson for us. We live in this world. We're told not to be of the world. We live in this world. We eat. We buy our clothes. We live. We raise our families. But the Bible tells us we're sojourners. If you're a believer in Jesus, you're just passing through. This is not your home. One day you're going to be called out of this world into your glorious permanent home. And you truly will be home. And Joseph is concerned by faith that his bones don't remain in Egypt. So Joseph died being 110 years old, and they embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt. What a fitting way for the book of Genesis to end. Coffin in Egypt. Not pleasant, but you see, with the hope of the resurrection. That's the key. He was certainly in the school of hard knocks, but he graduated with honors. And 400 years later, they will carry his bones out. Why do they come out of Egypt? Because God calls them out from the bondage. Wait a minute. Bondage. Joseph is like their savior. Yes, but as time goes on, a new dynasty will come that does not recognize Joseph. It's true in our day as well. You know, wouldn't I love if the leaders of this nation took the time to really delve into the founding fathers' writings, these geniuses that put together a constitution that has outlasted every single constitution in the world. It's the longest existing constitution in the world. France has had like 7 or 8 constitutions, total makeovers. And, you know, Germany, I don't know how many, and other countries have had plenty. America, we've had the same document. And I believe because of the revivals in this nation, we had a stronger foundation and a stronger understanding of human nature and freedom and the promise for people that you could come anywhere from the world and be an American. You wouldn't have to be under some tyranny. And I believe that that system was amazing, but you know what? I'm seeing changes more and more. There was an article in Pravda, which is a Russian publication, and the writer said something interesting. He said he was amazed at the American sheeple, he called them, instead of people. Heading so fast toward Marxism that it makes even the Russians blush. Moving in a direction that he's laughing at us, saying, you know, you guys let these people steal trillions of your dollars. And the same people who did it are now entrusted with managing the money that they're yet to take from you. And he goes on and just basically shows how Americans are more interested in who's who in entertainment than what's really happening in Congress, making decisions that are going to affect their lives. We care more about who wins American Idol than we do what these congressmen are saying and representing us. And you know what? It's true. We are basically kind of asleep at the wheel. Now, there are many Christians who say, well, look, you know, this is just prophetic. America has nothing to do in the end times, and so the Lord has to remove us. It's all part of His plan. I'm not going to fight it. I think in many ways that is very naive. I do believe in prophecy, and I do believe God is working this out, and eventually America will become a non-entity in the world scene. Prophetically, it has to happen. But listen, I don't want to be a part of that. I don't want to be the one that's doing that because I'm disengaged. I'm not being faithful as salt and light in this world. And I think it's important for us to recognize the opportunities we have. We do need a great revival again to stir this nation up. And I pray that God would bring it. But I think it comes down to the biggest problem in America. Someone once asked a man, what's the two biggest problems America faces? And he said, I don't know, and I don't care. And he goes, you're absolutely right. It's ignorance and apathy. You nailed it. And isn't that the truth for many? They can't be bothered. And you know what? This is the problem in our lives too. We care more about our present situation than the eternal value of a soul that will last forever. You can't put a price tag on that. You can put a price tag on these homes in Rumson. You can put a price tag on these estates over here in Colts Neck. You can put a price on some of these beautiful places, you know, they're 5, 6, 10, whatever, 20 million. What do you value a soul, a single soul? A hairdresser down the street at a local shop, or someone who's working on some landscaping, or someone who's in finance or business. What's the value of a soul? I pray that we don't make a mistake. And we lose focus and lose attention. And then when things don't go our way, we complain and we get frustrated. Look at the example here. Whatever happens, God intends for good. But He wants us to be engaged in being influential in this world, to touch lives. I want to close with one thought that I think bears thinking in regard to this. We've looked at these great themes in Genesis, the creation of the world, sin entering the world, the punishment of the flood, then God raising up the nations and calling Abraham out, and everything's moving in history to bring us to the coming of the Messiah. But what is our real goal and purpose in life? Why do we do what we do? Ken Ham, who founder and president of Answers in Genesis and basically built that creation museum, he was asked by a reporter, what's your game? Why are you doing this? Why are you building this creation museum, really? What's your real reason? He says, I'm building the creation museum so that people can have more confidence that the Bible is indeed accurate. So that in believing it's the Word of God, they would believe the gospel. And in believing the gospel could become saved. And in becoming saved could then become a part of the kingdom forever, and I would know them forever as my forever family. And the reporter says, so then you admit it. It's kind of like, it's religious after all. I knew it. And he goes, of course. And then the reporter said something very strange. He said, that's really refreshing to hear. And he said, why? And he says, because many times I interview these Christian leaders, they're doing some big thing and, you know, for humanitarian efforts or this or that. And they always say, well, we care about the poor, we care about the family issue, we care about this. But they never really admit that what they really want is to tell people about Jesus. And of course, I love Ken's answer. That's what it is all about. That's what we should be about. Why are we embarrassed about that? Jesus died for us. Why should we be marginalized? Why should we be told, you keep your little religious stuff on the reservation? Why should this not be something we can bring out in the public square? We believe. And the Bible, if you're going to believe any ancient book, it's got more reliability than any ancient book alive. So listen, I pray whatever you do, think in terms of eternity. Whatever befalls you, understand it's all good. For those who love God, God is working it all together for good. But the most important question that comes back then is, do you love God? Is He your God? Do you have assurance of your salvation? If you were to die today, do you know where you're going? That's what it boils down to, because that's where your soul, far more valuable than anything that ever existed in this world, is your single soul, which will last forever. You cannot put a price on it. You better tend to your soul. You better square that business away with your Creator who loves you and sent His Son to rescue you. But if you don't believe, if you do not put your trust in the Lord Jesus, there is no other lifeboat that's going to rescue you. Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by Me. But as many as received Him, to them He gave the power to become His children.